Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a number of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and speak with Fadel Gate, who was described in the New York Times on Friday as an elder statesman among oil analysts. We'll be talking to him about the extraordinarily high prices of oil, both at the pump and at the wellhead, and we'll be talking to him about whether he believes that by the end of the year, perhaps it may be as high as $100 a barrel. So we'll be talking about where the oil prices are going and also looking into the Venezuelan situation, given the remarks by the televangelist Pat Robinson urging that the United States assassinate the Venezuelan leader. We'll look into whether that kind of gratuitous warmongering might affect the price of oil as well, given that Venezuela, along with Mexico and Canada, are the largest suppliers to the United States. We'll also speak with Colonel E.M. Chamberlain, who retired after 30 years of military service from the United States Army. He's a full colonel. He's a graduate of the U.S. Military Academy at West Point. He was the commander of Task Force Stryker during the Desert Storm, and he became an aide to General Zinni from 1998 and to 2000 in the Gulf region with CENTCOM. And he's an avid student of military history, and he wrote a recent opinion piece in the Chicago Tribune titled Prediction: Forces of Politics, Not Warfare, Will Bring Iraq Pullout by 2006. And it's a very, very good analysis, and a much more pessimistic one in terms of the fact that the U.S. will eventually pull out of Iraq. There will be a civil war, and the Sunni will inevitably lose that civil war and then spill off into Saudi Arabia, where they'll destabilize the Saudi Arabian government, allowing bin Laden to take charge of Saudi Arabia. So in terms of a nightmare scenario, the worst possible outcome for George W. Bush and the people who brought us to war, it's almost a perfect storm of incompetence. And in the third segment, we'll speak with Dan Wright, who is in Crawford, Texas, which is the home, of course, the vacation home or the home of the President George W. Bush. He spends about 20% of his time in office on vacation and seems to prefer to go down there to Texas every summer, even though apparently it's an extremely unpleasant climate down there. Let's begin with Fadel Gate, who was described in the New York Times just this last Friday as the elder statesman among oil analysts for more than 30 years. He's had experience in oil and gas research and analysis, widely regarded having a comprehensive insight into the matters of oil and energy. And he is a native of Egypt. Fadel Gate is a graduate of Cairo University and New York University, and he's currently the senior vice president for oil and gas research with Oppenheimer & Company in New York City. And we spoke some time back where you accurately predicted $60 a barrel, which we've gone past now. You also said that by the end of the year it may be as high as $100 a barrel. Are you still standing by that prediction, Fadel?
Well, it's really our call. If we make another misstep in the Middle East, such as attacking the nuclear facilities in Iran, the $100 oil would be real low, very low price.
Well, am I being cynical to make the following connection? It apparently, and it's, I think this statistic may be a little old now, but I understand that the price at the pump for oil for the average consumer has gone up over 33% in the last year. Coincidentally, the profits for ExxonMobil have gone up 33%. So,
but see, I am. If you are cynical, and even more cynical. But to be fair, oil companies have no control over the price of oil, no matter what we say. Because in 1998, oil prices crashed to $10. Obviously, if oil companies had any input in the outcome and dictating where oil prices should be, they would not have allowed oil prices to go as low as $10. Half of the domestic oil and gas producers were very close to bankruptcy. Now, what really bailed them out, if you will, this almost perfect storm bad politics, bad policies, Mother Nature, demand in China, all of the factors that could have contributed to our oil prices took place at the same time. So we had oil prices move up from $17 in December of 2001 to $68 in August of 2005. Not one factor contributed to this surge in oil price. We can blame it on speculation and hedge funds and hurricanes and economic growth, unexpected economic growth in China, and miscalculation by our government. It's really all of the above.
So I guess it would be you wouldn't make then the connection that we have a president and a vice president, both of whom come out of the oil patch, and that it would take a bit too much imagination to imagine that these two, who are the architects of this disastrous war in Iraq, would have in fact deliberately screwed up so badly as to raise the price of oil so precipitously, so that their friends and colleagues would make tons of money.
Well, I will leave this to the conclusion of others, the people who will write history. But as an analyst, I can tell you, right, under the current administration, the oil industry made more in the last 5 years than they made in the previous 25 years combined.
Right.
So they would root for a third term, if you will, if we can possibly put George Bush in another third term. I guess, you know, the oil patch would definitely vote for that.
Well, what about the idea then that, for example, the Hawaiian government now talking about price caps? Do you, you know...
Again, it's politics. It's politics, and politics is always ugly. When government interferes, first of all, one we have to realize, government doesn't do anything right. This is number one, no matter what shape or form. This government is no different. Now, the Hawaiian state legislators are capping gasoline prices at the wholesale level at $2.15. That's a huge headroom, the spread between the feedstock cost, which is crude oil, and the $2.15 is about $27. That's a huge amount of profit. The companies that sell gasoline in Hawaii, basically Tesoro and Chevron, they do not make $27 per barrel on the break between gasoline and crude oil. So it's just more of politics, but it really doesn't have any impact at the end of the day.
Well, when you say, Federal Gate, that the government doesn't do anything right, who is the advocate for the people then in this free market globalized economy that we have? There doesn't seem to be any advocates for the consumer.
Not really, but I have to, you know, you can't blame government for all our ills. Government is one of our ills. It's a product of our bad judgment. We put government in place. We voted for the current government, so we should suffer for the next 3 or 4 years. I mean, it is our decision. They did not come there by force. We voted for them. Having said that, I can tell you here that when people go and buy SUVs, what's the government has to do with that? It is just very, narrow-mindedness on our part when Detroit give us a break to buy gas-guzzling cars, and at the end of the day, we consume more oil, not less oil.
Well, just to correct you, Fidel, the government has given an incentive for the longest time, a huge incentive to buy SUVs and Hummers. And a very small incentive to buy hybrids. And in fact, in the last energy bill, the H2 and the Hummers were exempt. I think they're built down in Texas, and you know, the chief of staff of George W. Bush is the former lobbyist for GM. So you get the distinct impression that the government, even though they just recently, after they passed the energy bill, they then talked about the need for stricter standards in conservation and better mileage. The facts are there that they have been with tax breaks favoring and encouraging people to buy these big gas guzzlers.
Absolutely, I agree with you. But we also have a chance to elect congressmen every 2 years, senators every 6 years, and then finally we elect the president every 4 years. Now, we should change that. And the only way we can change that, obviously, through voting them out. I mean, the people that we have not seen any comment by the liberal side of Congress, whether it's the New York delegation or the California, Clinton, the Schumer, the Boxer, and the Feinstein, to say anything about the rising oil price. They have kept their mouths shut, and I blame them for not speaking out.
Well, but don't you think, Fadelgate, that what's going to happen here as the Iraq war turns into a greater disaster and the American people turning sour on both the Iraq experience and in the Middle East in general, and as oil prices rise, they won't blame their own politicians for being short-sighted and for not transitioning to alternatives and encouraging conservation. They will blame the Arab sheikhs.
Well, I mean, that is the easy way out. That's a cop-out. The fact of the matter, we have an energy bill, in my view, that is like basically a Band-Aid for a gravely ill patient. That is not going to get us anywhere. It's an illusion. It's not going to get us anywhere. The fact of the matter that this energy bill, it's doomed to fail from the very beginning because it doesn't put conservation on the top of the list. Conservation should be something that presidents should be audited during their administration, how much energy efficiency we have introduced in the economy. And I don't care whether it's Republican or Democrat. This is a national security issue. And if American people are narrow-minded enough to not think that we are in Iraq because of oil, they are very mistaken.
Well, we are in Iraq because of oil, but the conspiracy theorists who say it was all about oil, the problem with their argument is that may have been the intention of this administration, but the result has been the opposite. It has made oil, distribution and the security in that region much, much more tenuous. It has led to what you describe as a fear premium. And now with saber rattling against Iran, there's not likely to be anything but a worse kind of environment now in that part of the world. And it's actually turned the United States into a paper tiger because many of the oil producers now are finding new customers because, we used to be the hegemonic power in that part of the world guaranteeing security. But our blundering footprint is now causing more trouble than providing security.
That's correct, because the fact of the matter that the idea was probably possible or likely to succeed if we had a plan. But this is failed to plan is plan to fail. And that's exactly what happened in Iraq. It was a knee-jerk reaction. We tried to get people from one direction into another. We used September 7 as an excuse to attack a country that had absolutely nothing to do with terrorism. It's a secular society. There was no Islamic fundamentalist in Iraq. There was no terrorism in Iraq before we got in. We removed Saddam Hussein. We should have quit while we're still ahead. We achieved our objective. We leave it to the Iraqi to decide. Now we've went from weapons of mass destruction to installing democracy. Who are we kidding? None of the Arab regimes that are friendly to the U.S. are democratic government, from Saudi Arabia to Egypt to Jordan to the old dictators. And we support dictators. We have been for quite a long time, and we will in the future. So why all of a sudden we are in this mission, if you will, of forcing our ideals and our system of government on Iraqis that have nothing in common with us?
Well, the fear premium that you referred to, Vattelgate, what is it per barrel now? Say, with $68 barrel, how much do you think of that as the fear premium?
Well, again, it's very difficult. As I said before, one statement from any senior official in this administration, and they seem to be able to make irresponsible statements all the time, could jack up oil prices. Look what happened on some, you know, a friend of Bush type of person, who is Pat Robertson, who says something that is totally stupid, that is totally reprehensible. But he, in a way, outside of this country and in Venezuela, he actually represents the mindset of this government. When he said that we should go ahead and assassinate a foreign leader that was elected by his own people.
Yeah,
I mean,
a couple
that
of times.
Only gets our situation worse.
Well, but I think that somebody, you know, these move-on people who was creating an opposition to George W. Bush, they ought to focus on something real, and that is that this man is responsible for, in part, for the cost of gasoline.
Just absolutely.
Because
absolutely.
Of his own reckless rhetoric.
If we had not instigated the general strike in Venezuela, and if people want to deny that we had a very major role in this strike, they are mistaken. We were behind. We wanted to topple Chavez. Chavez is a thorn on our side. He was the one who engineered the OPEC production cut that lifted oil prices in the at the end of 1998 from about $12 by the end of 1999. Oil prices were $27. And a year later, President Clinton had to release oil from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve to prevent oil from heating up to stop economic growth. So having said that, Chavez was our, you know, public enemy number one in the under Clinton and under Bush. Unfortunately, the impact negatively impacted oil supply because Venezuela did not produce oil for almost 6 months. It siphoned off about 500 million barrels of the global inventories, and that set the stage for other things to come. Once we started talking about the invasion of Iraq, oil prices in January 2002 were $20. By the end of 2002, oil prices were $30. The jump was basically because of the rhetoric about we are going to attack Iraq and Saddam Hussein and all this thing, and the general strike in Venezuela. And then when we started preparation for invasion of Iraq, Saddam Hussein shut off production completely, which siphoned another 200 to 300 million barrels of the global inventory. And that eliminated the cushion that people think this is the comfort zone for for the global demand and supply to get in balance in the event of supply disruption. So we lost this cushion, and that's why any perception of supply disruption is likely to push oil prices at a higher level.
Well, just in closing then, obviously in spite of tensions between U.S. and Venezuela, it remains one of the biggest suppliers to the United States. But they are diversifying. They are apparently building a pipeline with the Chinese across into Colombia so that the Chinese can access the oil through a Pacific port. I think that is true. Obviously, it's a seller's market out there. Do you foresee a time where the United States will be competing for the same barrel of oil with everybody else?
Oh, we are.
Already?
We are already for all practical purposes.
So why do they sell to us then?
Well, they are not for sale. Well, again, it's economics because it is cheaper to sell oil to the U.S., which is the largest oil market, than to ship it over to China because obviously it takes time, it costs money because of the transportation cost. But also China does not have the sophistication in the refining system to be able to take the Venezuelan crude oil, which happened to be heavy and have sulfur, that can convert it into light products, basically gasoline.
But we in this country haven't built a refinery, I believe, in the last 30 years. They're working at total capacity, and apparently there's no incentive on the part of anybody to build a new refinery.
There would be none.
The lack of refineries also give them the excuse to coming offline and running the prices up, don't they?
Absolutely. I mean, again, oil companies would invest if they assure that they will make profit. They are making a huge amount of profit, but they are not building refineries in the U.S. because of the costly environmental regulation. And finally, when the president suggested that he would encourage oil companies to build refineries on abandoned military bases, I tell you, I talked to the CEO of 3 or 4 very large companies. They almost laugh at it. They said that there's no way that you're going to do that.
Well, just in closing, what do you think about is the possibility of somebody, I mean, apparently it only takes a couple of mortar bombs to into the Ras Tanura oil refinery to shut down Saudi oil. So how tenuous a thread is our economic lifeline hanging on?
I would say Ras Tanura is not a refinery, it's a terminal.
The
largest oil terminal in the world.
Right.
This has been in the crosshair of terrorists from day one. They are from Saudi Arabia. They know where the nerve system, this is the nerve system for the oil supply around the world. And this is really the lifeblood of the global economy. It is very secure, but ultimately they will be able to breach the security. And when that happened, I wouldn't want to be around to predict where oil prices will be, because they will already be way ahead of any number that I have ever imagined.
Well, you've been right so far, and I thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. We're just speaking then with Fadel Gate, who was in Friday's New York Times and described as the elder statesman among oil analysts. He has predicted the current price of oil from 6 months ago and said by the end of the year it may be up to $100 a barrel. He's a native of Egypt, graduate of Cairo University and New York University, and is currently the senior vice president for oil and gas research with Oppenheimer and Company in New York City. I'm now speaking with Colonel E.M. Chamberlain, who has retired from 30 years of infantry service with the United States Army as a full colonel in 2002. Colonel Chamberlain comes from a family which has for 4 generations served this country as professional soldiers in the United States Army. He graduated from the U.S. Military Academy at West Point in 1972, commencing a career in which he earned many medals and commendations, including the Combat Infantryman's Badge, the Bronze Star for Valor, and the Distinguished Service Medal. He was the commander of Task Force Striker during Desert Storm, and the commander of the 3rd Brigade Combat Team, 4th Infantry Division, and as the Inspector General of Central Command under General Anthony Zinni from 1998 to 2000. He's had a piece recently in the Chicago Tribune that got my attention entitled Prediction: Forces of Politics, Not Warfare, Will Bring Iraq Pullout by 2006. Thanks for joining us, Colonel Chamberlain. Give me a sense of why you feel that that politics, not military considerations, will dictate the future of the force structure in Iraq.
Yes, and I guess the reason I say that is that the war right now is going along, and we are trying to bring democracy to Iraq, and we're slowly beginning to figure out that you're not going to bring democracy to Iraq. We've seen the last couple of weeks, and terminated on Friday, the problems they're having with the Constitution. I think that the Democrats who got pushed out in the last election are going to grasp this as an opportunity to make the case that the Republicans are not doing very well internationally, and it's having an impact on America. The discussion you just had about oil is certainly an indicator of that impact. To go back to democracy, to bring that to the Middle East or to Iraq in particular, that's a wonderful, wonderful ideal. But democracy requires a separation of church and state. We know that. That's in our own constitution. Western civilization figured that out back in the Middle Ages when we finally decided that the dictates of life and politics in all our countries would not be dictated by the Pope in Rome. As an example, the constitution they just completed, it specifically lays out that Islam will reign as the official state religion and the main source of Iraqi law. That's from the New York Times article yesterday. Clerics will, in all likelihood, and I'm quoting here, have seats on the Supreme Court, while they will be empowered to examine legislation to make sure it does not conflict with Islam. To go to the basic, if you will, difference between Islam and Christianity, is that Christianity says that God has given man free will. We are free to choose, and that's throughout the Old Testament, the choices he gave Job and Moses and all the rest of them. Islam, you do not have the will to choose. It is the will of God.
Well, but I guess the broader point here, Colonel Chamberlain, is that prior to the invasion of Iraq, Iraq was a secular country where there was no presence of al-Qaeda, even though the administration tried to make a case there was. And now, as you've pointed out, it's going to become a theocracy, whether it's theocracy light or theocracy heavy, it's kind of beside the point. Plus, it is clearly beset with terrorism, a tremendous and entrenched insurgency.
Yeah, the insurgency is the toughest part, obviously. We as Americans are not good at insurgencies as a rule, and that's because we fight fair, we respect non-combatants, and all those work very much against you in an insurgency. The last time we fought one successfully, if anybody reads the history books, was in 1903 in the Philippines. But the way we did it was the general in charge said that the province of Samar would be turned into a howling desert before he was done, and they proceeded to do exactly that. And it did break the back of the insurgency. We've done it successfully twice, once against our own American Indians, and then once in the Philippines. We have not done it successfully since then because we've become, thankfully, more civilized.
Well, what do you think the thing that I was impressed with from the piece that you wrote recently in the Chicago Tribune was that you're looking a little further down the pike here. You're suggesting that it's all we're in a situation in Iraq where we can't win, and many say we can't afford to lose. So we're stuck in that kind of no man's land. But your feeling is, and I think Brent Scowcroft echoed this feeling, was that the attempts to bring about a democracy and bring about these constitutions, etc., are likely to expose the contours of a civil war rather than bring about some unity in this otherwise broken country. But you take it further. You're suggesting that for political reasons we'll pull out before the 06 elections because the Republican Congress is going to say to the president, you got to help us here.
Right. I
imagine what we'll do is replace the soldiers with contractors, but I don't think they'll be able to hold the line. And they're apparently using more and more third world nationals. So we'll end up with a full blown civil war in Iraq, which the Sunni will inevitably lose because of the numbers and because Iran supports the Shia, and the Saudis and the Gulf and the Jordanians support the Sunni. And then you take the scenario further. You're saying that once the Sunnis are defeated, they'll retreat into Saudi Arabia, destabilize Saudi Arabia, and then Bin Laden may step in on a white horse. So it's kind of a perfect storm of unintended consequences.
I think it is, and I don't think it's unrealistic. When we got rid of Saddam, as you pointed out, there was a fellow that we knew. We didn't like him, but we knew what he was capable of, and he kept the clerics in Iraq in line, both the Sunni and the Shia. Well, the Shia clerics are now out of the box. We have the Islamic Revolution, the Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution in Iraq. Turns out that group has an army. Muqtada al-Sadr has an army. The Sunnis clearly have an army. That's who's fighting the insurgency. But the civil war in Iraq is already ongoing. We're just in the middle of it.
Well,
we're smack dab in the middle of it.
I think we don't recognize the depth of enmity here, apart from the fact that the Sunnis brutally dominated the country for the last 30, 40 years. During the Iran-Iraq War, the Badr Brigade, which is one of the major militias, were actually working with the Iranians. They were Iraqis fighting with the Iranians, and then all the captured Iraqi soldiers were brutally kept in concentration camps, guarded by their own Shia Iraqis. And this tremendous bitterness that the Sunni military have for the Shia.
Oh, yeah. But see, they practice a different kind of war that we're not used to, and that is where there are no non-combatants. And that's why if you look at the targeting right now in Iraq, that the insurgency, which is Sunni run, is they're targeting the Shiite. They're not targeting the U.S. other than to gather, you know, to make a hit with the Arab street that, hey, we're killing Americans too. What a great thing. But the Iraqis, Shiite predominantly, have lost almost 30,000 killed in the last 2 years, you know, to the 1,900 Americans. So the civil war is ongoing. We're standing on a side of it. And where it's going to go ultimately is, as I said in that article, I think that you're going to see an Iraq dominated by the Shia, aligned with Iran. I do believe that the House of Saud will be overthrown ultimately because the clerics have been working in Saudi Arabia for a while. They're frustrated. They don't think they have enough say with what goes on in that country. So I don't see any light at the end of this tunnel. There are several solutions, though, to as opposed to just pulling out and saying goodbye, it didn't work. The first one is obviously how do you end the war? Well, one is stay the course, as the president says. But as we predicted in the Philippines in the early 1900s, that's a generation or two to effect, to change the culture, the mindset of the people, so on and so forth. So you're talking 50 to 60 years in Iraq. I don't think the American people are interested. I don't think the politicians would be willing to take the heat of that many more casualties, that much more money. Second choice is to set an end date, preferably sooner rather than later, accelerate the training of the Iraqi army, which is already ongoing, give them conditions that we would like them to meet prior to us withdrawing, but then be prepared to withdraw whether they meet the conditions or not.
Yeah, but when you, Colonel Chamberlain, when you refer to the Iraqi army, it's not really an Iraqi army, it's a Kurd and Shia army.
That's correct.
So that's one of the reasons why the Sunni are fighting. They sure. See, the I think the reason the Shia aren't attacking us, except for the case of Muqtada al-Sadr, the reason they're not attacking us is that we're taking care of their next enemy, the Sunni.
Yes, we are. So and I think that's what we at the administration level did not realize as an effect of overthrowing Saddam and then having an election. You know, an election is a wonderful thing, too, but, okay, 60% of the population Shiite, two guesses who's going to win.
Right.
You know, and they vote along religious lines, not any other lines that you can think of. It's not like the two-party system here in this country. There is a third choice that's been kicked around a little bit, and I don't think anybody's taken it seriously yet, and that is to withdraw the coalition forces, which, of course, means U.S. and British predominantly, to the oil fields in the north and the oil fields in the south, not remain in the cities, but use those oil fields as leverage to force the Iraqis, Sunni, Shia, and Kurd to come to an agreement and to accept whatever form of government they come up with, and it may not be democracy. In fact, it won't be democracy. The only thing they have over there that's of any value to anybody is the oil. That's the only reason we're over there, is the oil.
Well, I don't know whether you've had a chance to read the piece in the current issue of Foreign Affairs by Andrew Krepinevich. I believe he's a classmate of yours in West Point, right?
Right, that's correct.
Well, his conclusion is that we're going to be committed there for decades and hundreds of billions of dollars, the American people, the American soldiers, the question remains whether they'd be willing to pay that price. And only by presenting them with a clear strategy for victory and a full understanding of the sacrifices required can the administration find out whether, in fact, that we're prepared to do that. And if Americans are not up to the task, Washington should accept that it must settle for a much more modest goal, leveraging its waning influence to outmaneuver the Iranians and the Syrians in creating an ally out of Iraq's next despot. So,
yeah, we've
boy,
got to be careful there. I mean, we did that in Vietnam and regretted it. We picked the fellow and then had to go in and kill him with the CIA because it's like Ahmed Chalabi. We thought he was going to be the man, and he's not the man for a whole bunch of reasons. But, you know, you get to the greater question, Ian, is why are we in the Middle East at all? I've been all over the place. I didn't see anything there worth writing home about. We're there because of the oil, as your earlier speaker just talked about. Imagine if we took the money and the intellect that we could buy with that money and said, let's come up with the next fuel source for the 21st century. If President Bush did that, his legacy would last for 1,000 years. His legacy now is that he started a war that he's incapable of finishing to his satisfaction.
Well, to anybody's satisfaction, by the look of it. I mean, this is the thing, the question, that, you know, you were part of the group that rebuilt the United States Army after Vietnam, and the president has put them in an impossible situation, which is the worst thing you can do in the national security business, is to put this country in a situation where there are no good options, and they're stuck in an untenable situation at the moment, and it's costing $6 billion a month, these two wars. And then, and if the scenario you're outlining, a full-blown civil war, and our boys and girls are going to be caught in a three-way shooting match, that is an even worse situation than we're in now. And the long and the short of it is that the jihadis already think they beat the Soviet Union in Afghanistan and brought down the evil empire, which is a delusion, because actually it was the Afghans that did the fighting, not the Arabs. But that's, you know, they nevertheless, that's their mythology. If they drive the other superpower out of Iraq, then they will really be drunk with power. So the long and the short of it is, has our president turned the United States military into a paper tiger?
I don't think he has. I mean, face-to-face, man-for-man, we win every time. There's no doubt of that. We won in Vietnam every time. There was no doubt of that. But you have to take into account the political will and what's the end result and what is it you want to get out of it.
Right, and the judgment of history, which is that we didn't win in Vietnam, right? I mean,
well, I don't know. We went to Vietnam to fight against communism, and the Soviets backed one side, we backed the other. Okay, we eventually left, but is the Soviets still around? No. We eventually bankrupted them. Vietnam was a campaign in that war. Depends on how you look at history, whether you look at it 10, 20 years, or 100 years.
Right, but I mean, give me a sense of whether we're winning in Iraq and no. whether this is a proper deployment of our military forces. I mean,
well, I think right now we're winning where we are, but that's the whole point of an insurgency. You win where you are as long as you're there, and as soon as you withdraw, the insurgents come back, retake the ground. That's why it's such a difficult fight. But I would get out of the cities. The best way to fight an insurgency is not to fight one. Again, I would take the oil fields. I'd sit on them. They're out in the desert. I've seen them. We can defend ourselves very adequately there. And then we have leverage for the Iraqis to do what we want them to do. Right now, we have no leverage.
But I guess the long and short is you don't think that anybody's picking up on what you're saying, that you think that we're throwing good money after bad and chewing up our boys and girls for no good strategic purpose.
Well, I've talked to a lot of the soldiers, and they feel individually that they're making a difference when they're there and when they can, you know, whether they're working on the infrastructure of the country, the schools, the hospitals, the water, the electricity. You know, we're doing great things for the Iraqi people. We really are, and that kind of gets lost in the shuffle. But we're not winning the insurgency, okay, and we're not making the civil war go away. In fact, that is the Constitution continues to flog around and not get approved. That will only increase.
So which scenario do you stand by? The one in the Chicago Tribune that we talked about earlier, or do you think that there's a possibility that, given what you suggested vis-a-vis the oil fields and what your colleague Andrew Krepinevich talks about?
I think the president has a choice right now. If he does nothing and he continues with his stay the course call, Congress and the American people, I think, will make the decision for him next year. His only alternative, as I see it, is to use the leverage that I spoke of.
I see. Well, I thank you very much for joining us here in Los Angeles, Colonel Chamberlain. And you write regularly for the Chicago Tribune?
About once a month on average, I guess. A little less, actually. It's whenever Charlie needs something.
I see. Okay. Well, I appreciate you joining us here in Los Angeles, Colonel Chamberlain.
Well, thank you for the opportunity, Ian.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking then with Colonel Ian Chamberlain, who served for 30 years in the United States Army Infantry, retired as a full colonel in 2002. He is a graduate of the U.S. Military Academy at West Point, and he's the recipient of the Infantryman's Badge, the Bronze Staff of Valor, the Distinguished Service Medal, and he served as a commander of Task Force Striker during Desert Storm, and as a commander of the 3rd Brigade Combat Team of the 4th Infantry Division, and as Inspector General of Central Command under General Anthony Zinni. And his piece in the Chicago Tribune recently was titled Prediction: Forces of Politics, Not Warfare, Will Bring Iraq Pullout by 2006. And although that was an extremely pessimistic scenario, he's offered other scenarios which may or may not be taken up by the Bush administration. I'm speaking with Ann Wright, who is in Crawford, Texas, which is the home, of course, the vacation home or the home of the President George W. Bush. He spends about 20% of his time in office on vacation and seems to prefer to go down there to Texas every summer, even though apparently it's an extremely unpleasant climate down there. How are you making out and there in the heat?
Actually today we've had a break in the weather. This morning we had a lightning and thunderstorm and got quite a bit of rain, and fortunately nobody was injured, and we were very concerned because we have a lot of people that are sleeping in tents, and then we have this big tent that we've been having a lot of our programs in, and fortunately the lightning stayed away from us, and it's cooler here today in Crawford. And on this Sunday we've had interfaith services this morning that were very moving, and followed by up at our camp number 2, we've had 3,000 roses that have been donated, and we placed roses on 200 of the crosses that we have at camp number 2, and we're just now starting a ceremony here at camp number 1, where over the course of the afternoon we'll be placing roses at the 856 crosses that are over in camp number 1. It'll probably take us most of the afternoon because we will be going down the long road toward Crawford, and in order for safety, we'll just have one person taking probably a dozen roses, and then one by one by one, they're placed on the crosses. And it'll probably take a couple of hours by the time we get these roses on all of the crosses.
And Ann, you're a veteran of the State Department. You resigned, I believe, in protest to the war in Iraq, and you're also a, 30-year veteran of the United States Army?
That's right. Well, 29 years, 13 on active duty and 16 in the reserves.
And earlier I had on Colonel Chamberlain, who just retired from the Army as full colonel. He was a commander of Task Force Striker in Desert Storm and worked with General Zinni at CENTCOM. And his scenario is actually much more pessimistic than anybody's. And he thinks that the civil war is happening. There's nothing we can do about it. The political considerations from pressure from the Republican Congress is going to force President Bush to start pulling soldiers out before 06. And then they'll try and replace them with contractors. But the long and the short, the civil war will break out. The Shia, who have the numbers, will win. The Sunni will lose. The Sunni will then spill into Saudi Arabia and destabilize that country, and then it'll eventually be taken over by bin Laden. So it's a kind of a perfect storm of incompetence. Does anybody, do you think, in the anti-war movement, talking about the sheer incompetence of this regime, let alone, you know, the moral and other issues, but is anybody
from the very beginning, my resignation was based on that, it was a bad political decision, had no authority in the international community, for example, of the authorization of the UN Security Council. We all knew that the United States going into an oil-rich Arab country would provide the magnet for all sorts of people all over the world, really, to come after America for doing that. The military plan that the administration, Rumsfeld and Cheney and all that gang cooked up, was known from the very beginning as being an incompetent plan, and General Shinseki, the secretary or the chief of staff of the Army, was fired for speaking out against it. I think I don't know that I share the pessimism of the person you had on earlier. I think it, I mean you can certainly draw. There are a lot of scenarios that could happen, but one scenario is that as long as America is in Iraq, then we are the targets. The Iraqis, I think, can resolve some things themselves, and I think it's not just America that should be there to offer advice or comments. There are a lot of other countries of the world that have had extensive dealings with the various factions in Iraq. And but the one thing from, I think, from the U.S. security point of view right now, as long as we are there, we become the lightning rod for everything.
Right. Well, you know, it's interesting.
If we're not there, then there is the potential for a resolution that I think is other than civil war, but we are contributing right now by our presence to a guaranteed civil war.
Well, it's interesting, Anne, that the former head of Abu Ghraib, General Janice Karpinski, who was essentially scapegoated, I think, for Abu Ghraib, she was demoted. She's now out of the military. She's now going public, and she's saying that, you know, for example, the man who stopped, installed the request for protective vests and armored vehicles was rewarded by Rumsfeld. He was made a four-star general, and now he's the chief of staff of the Army, General Cody. So there is a she says there's an absolute pattern. If you don't do what Rumsfeld says, like Shinseki, and contradict him, you get retired. But if you become a toady, you get promoted. So is that...
I think that's quite accurate. If you look at the Secretary of the Army, Thomas White, he was dismissed for his comments about what was surely going to be happening if they followed the plan cooked up by Rumsfeld and crew. This administration brought no dissent, and that's essentially why we are in Crawford. We are dissenting against these policies. We say that the voices of dissent, the voices of opposition, must be heard, and finally the media has picked it up. I've been saying this for over 2.5 years. I resigned in March of 2003, and I've been speaking publicly, consistently, at great frequency, and nobody ever hears about it.
Well, now they are. They're hearing about Cindy Sheehan. I mean, I must say that it's all over the press now. Is anybody down there talking to Cindy and guiding her? Because it seems to me that she's asking all these questions in the press about, you know, her opinions about the Arab-Israeli situation and other things that seem totally irrelevant to the fact that she's a grieving mum. Is there any danger that her focus is going to be diffused by, you know, becoming an advocate for a movement that she's may not necessarily be the main thrust for? I mean,
well, she's trying to keep focus very much on the fact that her voice is on this Iraq war, and she knows that people are trying to lead her down all sorts of paths, and she's trying to stay very focused. I think the media itself, and particularly the very conservative media, they pick at every syllable, at every word, and do all sorts of interpretations and allegations from anything. But Cindy is consistently on this Iraq war, and that's where that's her focus.
Yeah, so sometimes
Other people will try to just pull her apart and just run her through a shredder. There's no doubt it's already happened. But she stands there and, in a very common sense, logical fashion, asks the right questions that every grieving family has and really every American should be having to ask the public servant of America, it's our president, to respond to us.
Right. She's been accused of having taking money from from Al-Qaeda, and she pointed out that her checking account is overdrawn. And conversely, the people that the Bush administration have found to counteract her are driving around in expensive SUVs and motorhomes, and somebody's paying their way. So
Let's just look at what happened. I mean, who in the world ever get anyone, if you tried to plan something like this, and you tried to get people to come out in the hot Texas sun in the beginning of August, I mean, even the hardened peace activists, if you tried to plan this, they would say, you're stupid. We're not going to do that. I mean, it took somebody that says, I'm going. And I know exactly how it happened. I was there. I heard her on a...
Right. Well, we've run out of time, Anne, and I thank you so much for joining us from Crawford, Texas. I thank Lewis Vandenberg, the producer, Rusty Wynn, the assistant producer, and Carol Coote, and Jazz Shepard, the engineer.